The Federalist Society is a nonpartisan conservative and libertarian organization dedicated to freedom, federalism, and judicial restraint. FedSoc seeks to educate the legal community through its programs and publications about how limited constitutional government based on the rule of law can have a positive effect on the law and public policy.
Hi, everybody. I'm Patrick Valencia, also a co-president here at the GW chapter of the Federalist Society. We want to thank everybody for coming out. We especially want to thank the senator for taking his time, the senator's staff, and the wider GW community for helping us put this event on. The event's going to be moderated by Professor Kerr. He's going to introduce the senator, and then afterwards possibly give a couple remarks and field questions from students here. If you have class and you have to leave, feel free to do so, but please do so quietly and respectfully as the event will continue to go on. So, Professor Kerr.
Thank you. As introduced, I'm Oren Kerr. I'm a professor here at the law school. I've taught here since 2001. I'm going to keep these comments short because it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend a long time introducing somebody when you have come here to see that person. You already know who he is. So I have the easy job of introducing a person who, to my mind, is perhaps the most interesting, certainly one of the most interesting members of the United States Senate, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. He has represented Kentucky in the United States Senate since 2010. He is the scholar, or the senator who was the first to mention the Fourth Amendment in any presidential debate that I can recall, and therefore is a man after my own heart as a Fourth Amendment scholar. And that is not an accident. Senator Paul is, although not a lawyer, is more focused on the Constitution and the limits of the Constitution and the meaning of the Constitution than almost any other, if not any other, elected official. He really takes the Constitution seriously and talks about it, and it's a big part of what he does. The senator is a graduate of Duke Medical School in 1988, and then in 1995 founded the Southern Kentucky leading eye clinic. He is a physician and an eye doctor, an eye surgeon, not a lawyer, but really, as I said, takes the Constitution seriously, and we're very lucky to have him. So without further ado, Senator Paul.
Thank you, Professor Kerr and the Federalist Society. There's always some danger to a physician talking to a bunch of lawyers, particularly if I try to tread on your turf and tell you something about what you think you may already know more about than I do, which is very possible. But I'm also interested in provoking people a little bit to think. And so the introduction by the Federalist Society says we're for judicial restraint. And I think the topic's become maybe a little more complicated than it once was, what that actually means. So we're going to poll the audience to begin with. How many people are a yes vote on Lochner? All right. How many are a no vote on Lochner? How many just are indifferent because you don't remember what the hell? Anyway, it sort of split a little bit. I thought it may be more overwhelming than it has been. But I think it's actually been a debate a little bit in the National Federalist Society, sort of the idea of Lochner and the idea of judicial restraint back and forth, what that actually means. And I think an interesting way is it maybe divides conservatives a little bit from libertarians and lawyers a little bit from non-lawyers. So if you were to take Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and myself, you say, they're pretty conservative. They're pretty far out there on the right wing. But you ask them about Lochner, we actually disagree because I'm a yes on Lochner and they're both no's on Lochner. Because they're a little bit more in the camp of absolutely, we just shouldn't interfere, you know, with the states. We should sort of presume the right of them to act on their own, and judges shouldn't be legislators, etc. It also gets back to this fundamental question of what the presumption should be. And I think this is an important philosophical discussion. Should we presume constitutionality, or should we presume liberty? And Randy Barnett's talked about this some, others have talked about this some. But just the question of what the presumption is. And you say, it doesn't really mean much, right? Who cares whether it's constitutionality or liberty? What does that actually mean? Well, it becomes a big deal in some cases. So with Lochner, and you're talking about extended hours for bakers, should you sort of presume that it's constitutional unless it's flagrantly not? Is there any kind of presumption of a right to contract? Was there a due process argument? So the court decides 5-4 that there is a due process argument that people do have the right to contract with their employer. Contracts have sort of gone out the window since then. You're really not allowed to contract. You're only allowed to contract under certain things that the courts or the governments have said you can as far as your contracts go. But I think it separates libertarians a little bit from conservatives on Lochner. And you say, well, we're Federalists, we're for judicial restraint. Well, if you're a yes in Lochner, is that really restraint or is that activism? Or as Randy Barnett calls it, judicial engagement. If you plod along to one of the next cases, which has a little bit of a relation to Kentucky, is Buchanan versus Worley. Worley was a Republican, African-American in Louisville, and he challenged a segregation. It was a housing ordinance that said that a black person can't sell to a white person or vice versa. And it gets struck down unanimously, but interestingly, and for those of us who don't necessarily like Oliver Wendell Holmes that much, he had a dissent. He was going to vote no, even on a segregation case, because he so firmly believed that states ought to, you know, the progressive idea, the states were doing progressive things. He was going to leave the states alone, and he was so firmly for judicial restraint. Well, you get to the 1930s, and you have all the cases in the early 30s, and you have the four horsemen, the conservatives, and how are they all voting on the case, on all the cases? They seem to be voting actively to overturn the stuff the federal government's trying to do. So in some ways, you could argue the court of the early 1930s, before FDR finally gets his way and packs it, is sort of a judicially active court. And if you're someone for limited government, I was kind of with the four horsemen. I was with the people trying to overturn big government in the 1930s. You go on to Brown versus the board. We won't ask for a show of hands, but there's not too many people probably who are a no on Brown versus the board. But Brown versus the board, you could also argue, is a bit of judicial activism. But most of us would accept that there is a role for the court in that, and that there was a 14th Amendment issue. You get to Griswold. Does everybody know what Griswold is? So we'll poll the audience again. How many people are a yes in Griswold? How many are a no in Griswold? All right, a lot more no's in Griswold. Many of the people, or at least I think, conservatives who are no's in Griswold are for a variety of reasons, maybe judicial restraint, maybe that there was a presumption of a new right being created, but also they're no's because they see it as maybe a stepping stone to Roe versus Wade. But to my mind, I think that there is a presumption that you have certain rights that may not be listed, and I think that's one of the most important things about, you know, the Ninth Amendment. I had this discussion one time with Scalia, and he sort of, he was at a cocktail party. I think he was more interested in the party than he was me. But he kind of blew me off because I kind of said, you know what, you're not supposed to disparage. Those rights not listed are not to be disparaged. And he was like, you know, who's doing that and this and that? But that's the whole point. Do you have a right to privacy? I say, absolutely you do. Do you have a right to private property? Absolutely. Those rights not listed are not to be disparaged. The only way we got the Bill of Rights, the only way you could actually get it through is people were worried that it was going to be a complete listing of rights, and they said, it's better not to list any of them at all, lest people think that this is a complete listing of your rights. They put in the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. Very important and mostly ignored. Powers not given are reserved to the states and people, but rights not listed are not to be disparaged. You have a whole, you know, panoply? Insurance, but you have a whole bunch of rights, basically, that are out there that I think are yours and guaranteed by the Constitution. They don't have to be specifically limited. This becomes important when you get to the Fourth Amendment, too, whether things are explicitly, whether you have a right to privacy. And I think there's going to be, if we can ever get some court cases on the Fourth Amendment, I think there's the potential that we can get some real big changes. There are people on the left and the right that seem to be in favor of some of these changes. Sotomayor and others have said that the digital era has sort of changed things. And when you think about it, you think about, you know, the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment, the way it was written, was so awesome, but it still does sort of apply today. You know, back then it was papers, and people didn't want to come to your house because that was your privacy, that was your papers. Now if I ask any of you, which would you rather me do, have the password to your phone or come in your house and look at your papers, you'd probably rather let me come in your house, to tell you the truth. You probably may not want either one, which is what you should argue for, But the interesting thing is your phone is such a powerful, you know, tool that's so full of information that the government should have no right to look at your phone. One of the things that's coming up in legislation that we're going to fight is on Section 702, which has to do with how we gather information from foreigners, supposedly foreigners. But one of the things we've learned in the last couple of months and that I've challenged former Secretary Kelly, who's now the White House Chief of Staff, on is whether or not when you return to your country, you should have to divulge your password. They're actually literally detaining people at the border and saying, basically denying entry or promising you detention if you do not give up your password. I really think they ought to have a warrant for that. And I also think that there may be a distinction, and this is a little bit more of a detailed argument, there may be a distinction whether you're a citizen or non-citizen. In the country, the Constitution usually refers to person, so we're all sort of included under it. When you're coming into the country, I kind of tend to think you don't have necessarily all the rights of those who live in the country. But if you're a green card holder or a citizen and you're coming back to your country, I don't think you should be denied entry in your country simply if you won't give up your password. So I think there is some question on whether or not, you know, what the philosophy should be. But when we finally get to Obamacare, the biggest case, at least from my perspective, of the last several years, you finally get to this, I think, really convoluted, bizarre, distorted notion of judicial philosophy as put forward by the Chief Justice. You know, he says if you can imagine somehow that this is a tax, you must. If you can imagine somehow that it's constitutional, we must. Even if the government argued that it wasn't a tax, it was a regulation, or that it was a tax and not the regulations, it's immaterial what the government argued. If you can imagine that it's constitutional, you must. And I think it's an important debate. Napolitano writes about this some too, and talks about basically what others have talked about, presumption of liberty or presumption of constitutionality. And I think it's an important debate. Is there a role for an activist federal judiciary to overturn things that state legislatures do that take away rights? Well, if you have an expansive notion that all the rights aren't listed in the Constitution, that you do have a right to privacy, you do have a right to property, you do have a right to contract, that the privileges and immunities clause of the 14th Amendment means something, you could argue that maybe we would want a Supreme Court that actually does overturn laws. I think we went, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think we went from like the 1930s all the way to the 1990s without ever sort of having any limits on the Interstate Commerce Clause. We basically said you could do anything you want, and then I think there was a, somebody help me, what was the case in the 90s? There was a case in the early 90s where we started, Lopez maybe? But we started doing some of it, and that was with Scalia and other conservatives coming together and saying that we're going to it. But we went a long time, and government grew by leaps and bounds. And I think sometimes we, particularly the idea that we don't want justices to be legislators, it sounds really good, and we want justices somehow to be voting on a higher plane. That, and I know people even get offended by the idea that they're voting on the cases, but that's really what we're having. And I think everybody says, oh, I'm going to obey judicial restraint, I'm going to obey precedent until you get the lifetime appointment, then you can do what you want. And it's become sort of a, it's sort of an art form as far as how you get through the Senate confirmation. You have to say absolutely nothing, and you have to say absolutely I will follow the rule of the law and precedent, and then when you're on there, then you can do whatever the hell you want. But I think it's an important debate to have. With that, that's my lecture on judicial restraint. And versus judicial activism. We could do some questions.
Sure.
Anybody have any questions? We can go into other subjects too as well, or you can rebuke me for my my opinion on judicial restraint.
So given that counterterrorism kind of runs into issues of privacy, is there a point where you would say that you'd be willing to compromise a little bit of those privacy rights? Is there like a human life point?
There's a great description of this in the Suicide Pact by Judge Napolitano. And we've always had this question of whether you can trade some liberty for security. You know, and Franklin says if you trade liberty for security, you'll have neither. The way Napolitano puts this is he tries to define rights different than services. The government providing you a service, the national security apparatus or the intelligence agencies, they're providing you a service, so your security is a service, whereas your right to privacy is a right. He argues that they're two fundamentally different things and you can't exchange a right for a service, and that it's a false trade and you should never do it. I would say that when you look at danger and national protection, that there is a little bit of difference between those who are here and those who are not. So for example, if you are, you know, an American and you've gone overseas and you're fighting with ISIS and you're toting a gun, I think it's important because people kind of get lost in the whole Bill of Rights, Constitution. The Constitution doesn't really apply to you at all. I mean, if you're in a war zone and you're shooting at us, we're going to shoot you. No one's going to read you Miranda rights. They're just going to shoot you. So there is a difference between the war zone. It becomes a little more complicated, though, that let's say you're Al-Waqi. So you're Al-Waqi or his son, which we killed, or his daughter, which we killed, and you're overseas and you're a propagandist. Al-Waqi may never have ever raised a rifle or shot a bullet. Was he dangerous and an enemy of ours? Yes, but it's different. I mean, we have to sort of decide as a country whether, like Tokyo Rose, you know, would we all push the button to kill Tokyo Rose with a cruise missile or with a drone? I don't know. I mean, there has to be some question of where it ends. Do I have a problem with drones going around the side of the mountain and shooting 50 opposing soldiers? No, I mean, that's great. I do worry about when we can push a button and it goes 2,000 miles away or 3,000 miles away and we just kill someone. There's also the practical aspect of whether or not we actually kill more than we create. And I'll give you an example. We sent the Navy SEALs into Yemen recently. Does anybody remember us voting to go to war in Yemen? We are at war, allied with Saudi Arabia in Yemen. There's been no vote. It's absolutely terrible and unconstitutional. But also from a practical point of view, we sent a Navy SEAL team in there. They killed some people, including Al-Waqi's daughter. I don't know how the Al-Waqis show up everywhere, but they killed the daughter, they killed several women, and they killed some Al-Qaeda targets. Now, they all claim it's worth it, but they won't even tell me what they got. I've asked them in secure hearings, what'd you get? Oh, we got some good stuff. It's really going to be good for the country. We're really keeping you safe. But they won't even tell specifically what they got, so I have to trust these people that it was worth it. But I can tell you this. This is my theory. If you live in Yemen, my guess is you heard about the night the Americans came and that they will talk about it for 1,000 years, and they will talk about the fact that they came and killed everyone in the village. I don't know if they killed everyone, but they did kill several of the women, several of the kids. It's hard on our soldiers. I got three nephews who are in the armed services. I don't blame our soldiers, but I do blame our politicians for putting our soldiers in a situation like that. But I promise you, for 1,000 years, they're going to talk about it. What's the other thing they're going to talk about in Yemen for 1,000 years? They're going to talk about how the Saudis came with American bombs and American guidance technology, and they bombed a funeral procession, and they killed 150 people, and 500 people were wounded. See, we're more concerned about Britney Spears or some kind of actress on TV or what they're wearing. They still talk about the Battle of Karbala in 832 AD. I mean, these people have a long history. They're not going away. They live there. And, you know, one of the most famous comments over there is, you know, you guys have the watches, but we've got the time. They're going to stay there forever. Are we going to stay in Afghanistan forever? But I guess back to the fundamental question, is there a trade-off? I think there can be a different standard. There isn't always a Fourth Amendment standard for privacy for everybody in the world. For us, there is. If you are in the United States, you get protected. And it's important. It's not just citizens. It's all persons in the United States. But coming in, I can even agree to a little bit of a lower standard, like the 702 standard isn't probable cause to get information. But I do worry we've gone too far when we collect all of the phone information in Italy. We have a whole month's worth of data for everybody in Italy. When we're collecting Angela Merkel's private cell phone calls, I worry that we've gone too far. When we have billions and billions of phone calls stored in Utah desert of Americans' data, I worry that we've gone too far. So to my mind, you shouldn't have to give up liberty for security. And if you ever do, the error should always be on the side of liberty.
Thank you.
This is about a recent event with yesterday and Jeff Sessions announcing the Trump administration's decision. Do you agree with the Trump administration that DACA was unconstitutional? Also, do you think the House and Senate actually have a chance of passing legislation that would extend and make permanent the program?
Yeah, I think the executive branch acts in an unconstitutional manner probably almost every day. Republican or Democrat. I mean, it's been going on a long time. And if you talk about the biggest danger of you losing your freedom or liberty, is from executive overaction. The biggest danger of your country going to war in a war that we shouldn't be involved in, once again, executive action. So DACA, I think most of the courts, there's been several court cases and they've all agreed that it's unconstitutional. He created law. Now, that has nothing to do with the argument of whether he should have it or not. I'm actually somewhat sympathetic to the kids who have been here for most of their lives, but I'm also sympathetic to the idea you can't have no rules. I mean, you just can't. I'm sympathetic to Milton Friedman's point when he said, you can't have open borders in a welfare state. We got a lot of free stuff in our country. Free healthcare no matter what, free education no matter what, up through 12 grades. That's just a big expense. You just can't have the whole world come. There was a survey by Pew one time, I think it was Pew or Gallup, and they surveyed the world and then they extrapolated and they said 700 million people would come here if they could. So we've got to have some rules. Now with the DACA kids, what I proposed is the compromise is they're here, they're illegal, and you want to make them legal. We accept about 1 million people a year through green cards who then go get on the track to become citizens. Make the DACA kids part of the million. Now there's 1 million of them, so they would take up a whole year's worth of immigration. So let's say you wanted to not be take up all the slots. Let's say we divide them into segments of 200,000, we admit them over 5 years. We internally immigrate them over 5 years, but they count against the numbers. So for the people on the right, we say, we're not expanding immigration. We're not necessarily rewarding. We're not going to take 1.2 million next year. We're going to take 1 million and 200,000 slots of the people who've lived here 15, 20 years. And then I think that, to me, would be the reasonable compromise. I don't think that's what I'm promoting. I don't think we'll get that. I think what we'll get is you'll do DACA, and it'll pass, and then they'll throw a bunch of money at a wall or some security stuff. And in the end, the last comprehensive bill, one of the reasons I opposed it is they actually had too much money for border security. They just threw billions and billions and billions trying to get conservatives on board with the immigration reform. With immigration in general, most immigrants are an asset to our country. Most of them are good people. Most of them are hardworking people and should be looked at that way. But it still doesn't mean I'm for an open border. With DACA, you should have to obey the law. And one good thing about it, and I know everybody wants, it's popular to hate the president right now, but the thing is that he did something. He's going to force Congress to do their job. I mean, that's what he's, you know, if you read his Twitter account, that's what he's saying he wants us to do, telling us to do our job. And it is true. I'm trying to do something similar to that. So he's forced DACA back to us. If it's very unpopular to send these kids back to their country, or who knows, someone might not even speak Spanish or whatever language, if that's not popular, Congress should fix it. I'm trying to do the same thing on the authorization of use of force. I don't think the 2001 AUMF applies to anything we're doing now. I don't think the 2002 in Iraq applies to anything we're doing now. So I have an amendment to the defense authorization bill to let it sunset in 6 months. So the similarity to DACA would be, in 6 months, Congress has to either pass a new AUMF or they won't have any authorization at all. Here's what I predict will happen. One, I'll lose, which is a common occurrence. But I'm holding it up. So when John McCain came back at midnight and he asked for immediate expedited consideration of the defense bill, I objected. And everybody's like, why are you objected? He's sick and he's come back and this is his big thing. Had nothing to do with John McCain, but it has to do with, one, they're spending way too much money, but two, it has to do with we've been fighting war for 16 years without an authorization. There's a whole bunch of people on both sides who argue that we should have a new AUMF, but mark my words, most of them will not vote for a six-month sunset. They'll say, oh, that's too dramatic. And my response to them is, well, it's been 16 years and 6 months. How long do you want to wait till we actually address the issue that we should be addressing? But so I support what Trump did on DACA. I do support a compromise and probably will vote for some sort of compromise. But I think the best compromise would be that the kids that are going to be internally immigrated would be taken from the numbers of people. I would also do something for the same 11 million people. The 11 million people who are here undocumented or illegally, I'd gradually start internally immigrating them. They'd have to work, and as long as they're working, they got to stay. And I would also say one other thing before we move on. This is something that I think liberals get completely wrong about the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island. They're all forever saying, oh, we're this country, that everybody can come. Go to Ellis Island. My grandmother came in through Ellis Island. We went and looked it all up, and we talked to him and met him. Ellis Island was a harsh taskmaster, and there were a lot of rules. And people got sent back if they weren't healthy. Families got separated, but there were rules. And there was a host of rules, and there were people looking at the way you walked. There were all kinds of rules as far as getting in our country. And I don't think rules are necessarily a bad thing. And I think we need to change our immigration if we do, not to necessarily be more restrictive, actually maybe to expand some of our numbers, but to base it on work and people who want to work. And we could probably have more of them, not less. Yes.
Thank you. Hi, Senator. I'm really glad that you love Randy Barnett as much as I do. I'm a huge fan, so it's really exciting to see someone in the Senate especially preach about him so much and name drop him all the time. But one thing that I wonder is that very few in the Senate, I would suspect, agree with you on your view of original meaning, originalism, and judicial engagement. But what brought you to accept that when so much, especially probably at the time you got into it, was more focused on restraint?
I think reading some of his books, reading some of Judge Napolitano's books, who I think is a wonderful writer, and I read stuff that are more for the layperson than the lawyer, because I want something that is readable, but I'm fascinated by it and by the history of it. There's another book called Overruled by Damon Root, and that's a good book also, and that's about the Obamacare case, and really goes through it, and it is really... really disappointing for those of us who wanted better, like from Justice Roberts, to have this opinion, which I think is a bizarre opinion, that you're so caught up in that we don't want any kind of judges creating law that we acquiesce to whatever nonsense Congress passes, whether it's constitutional or not. And I think that's still a big case and a big deal, the Obamacare case, more really from the idea of the presumption of constitutionality than the specifics of health care.
So this is a question about the Electoral College. So the direct popular vote movement, especially since last November when the president lost the popular vote and won the electoral vote, has been gaining a lot of steam. And this interstate compact between, I think, 12 states is almost 200 electoral votes. And I'm sure you're familiar with the compact that if they get to 270, it will trigger, then they would give all their electoral votes, these states, to the popular vote winner. So what do you think of the interstate compact? Do you think it's constitutional? What do you think of the direct popular vote in general? And what could the federal government do to stop it if you think it's unconstitutional?
Our founding fathers in general thought democracy was a terrible idea. And you say that, and if you did, and I was careful to say they thought that, not me, because people would take that quote out of context and they think you're a horrible person, you're a terrible American. How can you be patriotic if you don't appreciate democracy? They didn't like democracy. They wanted sort of an indirect democracy. They wanted a republic. They wanted some kind of laws to restrain majority rule. And particularly when people from the left tell me they're for democracy and we need to get away from this old-fashioned idea of the Constitution, I try to point out to them that, democracy is what gave us Jim Crow. The Jim Crow laws were passed by majority legislatures. Now, some will argue, well, they'll say, blacks didn't get to vote in those states. Even when you add up all the black vote that could have voted, these were a majority of all these southern states passed these Jim Crow laws. That's when you do need a court system to step in an undemocratic way and say, you can't have that. You got to have equal treatment under the law. And so I want an activist court when there's a Jim Crow law. I think... one of the things that I'm also interested in, and I think is interesting from a law perspective, is the famous dissents. I think the dissents are more important and more interesting, actually, than the victories on the court. Brandeis's dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson, it takes 50 years to overcome it, but it's one of the beautiful things about our country. It's not that we went 50 years doing the wrong thing, but that we're stable and civilized enough that we finally did the right thing after 50 years of doing the wrong thing. With Plessy, I guess, finally being reversed with Brown. Other cases like that, the Olmstead decision back in the 1920s basically said your phone calls were not private, that the police could tap your phone calls without a Fourth Amendment. That finally gets reversed in like 68 with the Katz decision. Long time. We have the same thing going on right now. They say that my records, if you're my bank and I give you my records, I have no right to privacy. This third-party doctrine on records. I think they're completely wrong. And that's why, if you'll vote for me for the Supreme Court, I will promise you I will overturn Maryland versus Smith and a couple of other those, because I think they're wrong, completely wrong. But no one's ever going to say that because you would never get on the Supreme Court if you said you think some previous decision wrong. In fact, you can't talk about any decisions. But once you get on there, you can make those arguments. But really, I think we really do need to overturn and change the third-party rule on privacy. And some of it could be contracts. I guarantee in the contract, if I give you my banking information and says you're not supposed to share it, then the government says, oh, except for with us. Well, that's precisely the people I don't want you sharing my information with, is the government, even more than my neighbor. So I'm against electoral college, changing electoral college. The electoral college is maybe less than democratic, but it's a way of preserving. We sort of preserved democracy of population, but then also regional variety. Senate does the same thing. Senate's not democratic at all. Should the senator from Wyoming have the same vote as a senator from California? So if you get rid of the electoral college, you probably want to get rid of the Senate too, and I can't have that at all.
All right, so for a little while, there was a debate in Congress about passing comprehensive prison reform. I'm just wondering, has that been permanently shelved in Congress, and what your stance is on prison reform?
I'm for almost any criminal justice reform you can name. I'm for it. I wrote recently with Kamala Harris about bail reform. And one of the reasons I'm for bail reform is, and I would suggest that everybody read this in here, it's probably the most dramatic case I've ever read, and you should all know the story of it if you have a heart and want to have a heart about our judicial system, is the story of Kalief Browder. See, who's heard of Kalief Browder and his story? Not many. You should all read it. It was in the New Yorker about a year and a half ago. He was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack. He is put in Rikers Island. He's 16. The bail's $3,000. He cannot come up with bail, so that's the first problem. But here's the second problem. He was kept for 3 years in Rikers Island, 2 years in solitary confinement. He was beaten by guards, beaten by prisoners, which also shouldn't happen in our prisons, and then ultimately tried to commit suicide in prison several times, got out, never could function again, and then committed suicide and unfortunately was successful. We need reform of this system. The other thing you need to be aware of, and this will be way out there for some of you in the Federal Society, Michelle Alexander. Read her book about, can anybody remember the name?
The New Jim Crow.
Say again?
The New Jim Crow.
The New Jim Crow, because it talks about, and I think this is an important distinction also, it is not, most of the disparity in our outcomes of our judicial system is not intentional racism, I don't think. I don't think the cops are all racist. I don't think the mayors and judges and lawyers are all racist. But I do think there's a disparate outcome when you look at who's in prison. If you measure drug use from whites and blacks, it's about equal by most surveys. But if you look at the prison, 4 out of 5 people in prison are black or brown. They don't have the resources. They do worse on plea bargaining. Every step of the way, they don't do as well. And the answer to it is somewhat not having such a harsh war on drugs and not putting people in prison for drug use. But the other answer is we do need to be conscious of it as far as the disparity in this. And I think it also leads to some despair, anger, and a lot of the other problems we have. And I can promise you, all you got to do is think of, if you're a rich white kid and live in the suburbs and you smoke pot in your parents' basement, what are the odds of you being caught? Almost zero. But if you're a poor kid in the city and there's no place you can go inside and you're smoking pot on a corner, you're going to be caught. And so 9 times out of 10, you're going to be caught. And the white kid in the suburbs, or rich kid, doesn't always have to be white, is not going to be caught. So this disparity adds up over time. So I'm for almost all of the criminal justice reform that you can name. Bail reform, letting people vote again, expunging records. And it's actually become a bipartisan thing. In my state, the governor is Republican, evangelical Christian, conservative as you get. But we passed an expungement bill that says, I think it's not all crimes, but for many crimes, after a certain period of time, your records get wiped clean. And from a Republican point of view that doesn't want a huge welfare state, I want people to work. If you've committed a crime, you're not going back to work. If you've got a record that prevents it, and you're either going back to committing crimes, but to get people back to work, and not everybody will. I mean, a third may work, a third may commit more crimes, and a third are going back to jail. But we have a chance with some people if we'll let them have a second chance.
Senator, I want to go back to the question of the role of the courts. And in particular, for fans of limited government, how much can one expect to get those limits out of the courts as compared to out of Congress or state legislatures? So people disagree on what the Constitution means in good faith, just because right. people have different views. And history suggests that presidents are going to nominate people that will tend to further their political views, and probably senators, history suggests, will tend to vote in favor of or against nominees based on whether they think that nominee will favor their political views. And if that's true, how do you get courts to impose limits that are contrary to the interests of the nominating president and the right. affirming senators? Is it sort of baked in that the courts can't get very counter-majoritarian? Right. And if so, what does that mean in terms of fans of limited government seeking relief either from the courts or from legislatures?
Right. I mean, I think it's a tough question, actually. I think one of the things that's going to be the most dramatic change over time with the Supreme Court, and whether it's more or less ideological, is the fact that we're doing it by simple majority now. And we went a long time saying you had to get 60 votes, and the only really controversial one was Clarence Thomas, who I frankly think is the best justice. But, you know, he won 52-48. But now you're going to get a lot. Gorsuch, I think, won, what, 56, 44? He had a couple of Democrats, but it was very partisan. But I think you will see a little more of a partisan tilt of the Supreme Court and the appellate courts because we're doing it through simple majority. How do you set limits? This is where I have the mixed feelings on whether I'm for more judicial engagement versus restraint. Because on the one hand, I do think the Constitution means something, and I think the limits are real and in there. But I think I see most of majoritarian government, most of the things being passed by government, as contrary to the limits. It's not that we're overturning too many bad laws. We got way too many laws being promulgated that are completely ignoring the Constitution. In fact, if I were to look at, let's say we pass 500 pieces of legislation next year, I would say probably 495 of them are unconstitutional because there is no explicit authority or power. We've gotten to, you know, we debate philosophically whether it's a real original constitution or a living document or a living constitution. It's absolutely only a living constitution according to the legislature. Now, that's my opinion. There are my dad used to make the joke. He said the only two things that will be completely discounted and not regarded as an argument and debate would be morality and constitutionality. And so I think we don't really live in a republic, a constitutional republic. I think we really do live in almost a pure democracy right now. And because of that, there isn't a restraint in the size of growth of government. And because there is no restraint in debt, government can do anything. So we're going to pass, you know, my family lives in Florida. My sister's got 2 feet of water in her house as we speak. But the $8 billion they want to give, I'm going to ask them they take it from some other part of the budget. But I'll be the only one. My staff looked this up. In 2012, I did the same thing. I got only 3 votes. I think it was Mike Lee, myself, and Heller voted in 2012 to offset it by taking foreign aid money we're going to give to someone else, and actually giving it to our own people instead because we're out of money. People say, oh, no, we should help the poor people in other countries and help our poor people in our country, too. And it's like, where's the money going to come from? We're $500 billion in debt this year. We'll be $1 trillion in debt next year. And the only argument you can make for not offsetting the spending is, oh, but I'm compassionate. I want to help people. And that's the biggest problem we have in Washington is we have a big heart, small brain syndrome. And everybody's compassionate with someone else's money. You know, try asking people to give some of their own money, and we'll see how far that goes. But it's always easier to give somebody else's money. But I don't know if I answered your question. It's a tough question because I think that we should be restrained and our justices should be restrained by the Constitution. Jefferson talked about the chains of the Constitution. They were supposed to mean something. Not on the people, not to restrain the people, but to restrain, you know, the legislature. And the courts were supposed to be part of that. But we've gotten so far away from that, you know, for so long. Once the Interstate Commerce Clause began to mean anything, you know, that didn't, you know, that even domestic manufacturing within a state could be, you know, because eventually it got on a road somewhere and eventually went somewhere, we could, you know, regulate all domestic. Once we decided that, we decided we could regulate anything. And now that Justice Roberts says, well, we'll just call it a tax, you can regulate anything in the world, just call it a tax. So if, you know, what was the case they talked about, we can make you eat broccoli, but we're not going to penalize you, we're going to tax you for not eating broccoli. And that would be fine with Justice Roberts. Hope he's not listening anymore. Anybody else?
Over here. Hi, I'm Kulia. I've been a military spouse for 20 years now almost, and we live in a semi-socialist world to protect the Constitution and democracy, and I'm really troubled by the pulling back of the ability of transgender service members to be able to serve. But I'm more on another level feel like as military families, transgender kids are getting ignored who only have access to health care through the military, particularly those that live overseas. Do you think that there is a legislative or judicial argument to protect these children's access to care when their parents are serving the country?
You know, I thought we should have stopped before we won. You got we won one question too much. The first thing I would say is that I think to be in the military and your rights in the military aren't the same as being a citizen. So,
the service member.
What's that?
For the service member.
For the service member, yeah. Because the service members, you're not talking about service member, you're talking about people related to a service member.
Mm-hmm, spouses and kids.
Okay. Well, then I'm confused then because I don't think nobody's restricting health care for what they're restricting, what, some kind of sex change operation for people?
Sex changes don't happen before 18, but 18-year-olds are losing access to services. Transgender kids whose parents are serving in the military are losing access to medical services, not including
sex change. We could have a long debate, and I don't think this 18. Is probably the place to get into it. All I would say is there are more than one opinion over whether or not it's a good idea to do some of that. And there's, you know, I mean, I just hate to get into this because it's so emotional, but there's a lot of suicides among people who have had this done. There are a lot of people really unhappy they did it. There are a lot of people really confused about this over time. There's some maybe that are happy. All I'm saying is that when it's really controversial what's going on, it shouldn't be, it's not really, to my mind, the same as getting your gallbladder out or having a bypass surgery.
So you disagree
surgery.
With the AMA on that?
Well, excuse me?
So you're disagreeing with
well,
the AMA
Well, that's
on
why I can't get, you know, I'm not sure if I want to go any further than that. That's just my opinion. I'm just telling you my opinion.
Do you
and
think?
I don't see it as being the same.
Let's move on. We've got time for one more question.
Right here. Over here.
Hi. As I live in the district, and I haven't changed my residency to the district because I don't want to lose my federal voting rights. I'm still registered in Pennsylvania. I still go back to Pennsylvania regularly. Do you have any stance on the D.C. either getting statehood or the people living in D.C. getting voting rights in neighboring states to vote for a federal representative?
Right. The problem with sort of the idea of statehood, from the very beginning, they set D.C. aside and they decided it wasn't going to be a state. You know, that was the original intent of the Founding Fathers. On the one hand, it does sound kind of unfair sometimes, and it's also very partisan because D.C. votes like 90% Democrat, and so people would see it as an automatic, you know, two new Democrat senators. I wouldn't vote in favor of it, and I would frankly tell you that some of it is political reasons as well. But I also would be, if you told me that it's not fair and you're being taxed somehow without representation, I'd probably vote to get rid of your tax, because if your vote doesn't count, I'd get rid of your tax. Thanks, everybody.